proceed to the third case, Lim versus the trustees, Indiana University.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Richard Waples, and I'm here representing my client, Dr. Susione Lim, who is here in court with us. The ultimate question in this case is who gets to decide whether or not Dr. Lim's claim of gender discrimination in her tenure decision violated Title VII, whether it's the judge or the jury. Because Dr. Lim presented sufficient facts before the court in opposition to the defendant's motion for summary judgment, that question should be resolved, reserved for the trier of fact, the jury, and not the judge. Because the judge below erroneously usurped the trier of fact's function, summary judgment was inappropriate in this case, ought to be reversed and remanded for trial. Dr. Lim's evidence of discrimination consisted of both direct and circumstantial evidence. Her direct evidence of discrimination included President Brand's admission that gender played a role in her adverse tenure decision. This is the president of the university involved in the tenure process.
What did he say?
He said, in response to Dr. Warfel's complaint in writing, bringing Dr. Lim's adverse tenure decision to his attention, that he was already aware of the problem in Dr. Lim's tenure decision. He said that Dr. Warfel's example of Dr. Lim's adverse tenure decision was a well-taken example of the unfairness in the medical school to women.
Well, is this incorrect? I just noticed on page 10 of the, I guess it's the red brief, it says of the 42 female tenure candidates in the School of Medicine who completed tenure review during the 10-year period, et cetera, 41 received tenure. Lim was the only one who did not. Is that incorrect?
Well, that was presented in reply down below on summary judgment, and we did not.
So you don't know whether that's a fact or not?
We don't know whether that's a fact or not. We do have
that she was picked among whatever the number, 28 men and 14 women, and she was chosen originally out of that. She beat out a lot of men to be chosen, and then the final six, I think there were 4 and 2, and she was picked.
It's true during a selection process for a candidate for an open tenure track position that IU rated her number one among its candidates because of her qualifications were so high. She was admittedly the most outstanding cell biologist, which is what they wanted to bring to the campus, was a cell biologist. The Department of Anatomy wanted to beef up its cell biology program. In fact, they admitted that Dr. Lim was rated number one. They did offer her the position. She did beef up their graduate program. Dr. Burr admitted that she was the most important faculty member to their graduate curriculum in cell biology, and in fact, the Department of Anatomy was able to change its name from the Department of Anatomy to the Department of Department of Anatomy and Cell Biology because of her efforts.
Well, it seems that, and this is just looking at it from a distance, that she has outstanding credentials, but she does not have the use of the English language to her advantage. Where is she from? What's her native language?
Dr. Lim, it was educated and grew up in Malaysia.
Okay, but she speaks what? What's her native language?
It's English.
It is English? Is it an accent or something that is?
No.
No, I'm just asking you because it seems that is the problem. Of both her writing and the student evaluations of not being able to understand her and things like that.
Well, she does speak with an accent.
And so it may be a stupid rule to have all these publications and things like that, but I don't see the gender issue.
Well, Dr. Brand, or President Brand certainly saw it, and that's why he attributed it
in
to gender discrimination.
Sense.
Well, in the global sense, but he also tied it to her particular decision. And there's evidence in the record that he is a decision maker within that process.
I don't want to intervene. These statistics seem not...
Well, there's a lot of statistics in this case. The district court seemed to ignore our statistical evidence that we didn't have an expert on it. We did, Dr. Mary Brand. We also had Dr. Kathleen Warfel, who put the gender statistics in context also in this particular case. IU admittedly has practiced historic discrimination in tenure-track positions, offering tenure-track positions, hiring from the relevant labor pool women for tenure-track positions. And they're underrepresented in tenure-track positions at School of Medicine. The Department of Anatomy has never had a woman that was tenured until after Dr. Lim's tenure was denied. We can't really ignore the fact that there has been historic gender discrimination in the basic sciences and in the health sciences across this country and at the University, Indiana University, and at School of Medicine in particular. Defendants admitted that. Those facts are there. I think those are circumstantial evidence that helps place in context Dr. Burr's adverse tenure decision. You take President Brand's explanation that he found that it was well taken example of discrimination, one which he was already familiar about. He said he was already aware of the problem. He doesn't say how he became aware of the problem, but he says he's aware of it. That's an acknowledgement, direct evidence of discrimination that takes this case out of McDonnell Douglas analysis and allows the case to go to the jury on the ultimate issue of whether or not there's sufficient evidence, both direct and circumstantial, from which a reasonable trier of fact could conclude that discrimination was a motivating factor in her tenure decision.
Well, was there any further... let me phrase it this way. Was Dr. Brand deposed beyond the production of this letter?
No. No. We actually didn't get the letter until in response to their summary judgment motion, and we had Dr. Warfel prepare an affidavit which I really request the court to read in detail. We submitted it in our appendix, but if you look at that, she in detail compares Dr. Lim's treatment and her qualifications for tenure with Dr. Williams, and I don't think any rational person reading that affidavit could come to the conclusion that they were treated equally or fairly, or that Dr. Lim's gender was not a motivating factor in her adverse tenure decision. Dr. Warfel, in helping us in this case and preparing that affidavit, produced to us this letter. It had not been produced to us by the defendant in discovery. That was the first we saw, but we submitted in response to summary judgment. We had not taken President Brand's deposition. We did submit the letter. In response, in reply to our response to their summary judgment motion, they submitted President Brand's affidavit, in which he attempts to explain the words that he used in that letter. But there's no ambiguity in the letter itself, in the face of the document.
They offered certain excuses for their tenure decision. Do you claim those are pretextual?
Well, I think because we offer direct evidence, we don't have to prove pretext, and I think the case law of the circuit and other circuits are right there. But we do think that there is evidence of pretext. They say, she's an outstanding scientist, she just wasn't productive enough. She didn't meet our quantitative goals of number of publications and authorship placement, either first or last authorship placement. And we say, the tenure decision is supposed to be pursuant to the policy of the university based upon whether some gauge of whether this person is an excellent scientist. We can't lose track of and just get caught in numbers.
Why is there an indication that wasn't considered? In other words, that the excellent scientist aspect wasn't scored as a plus. It's just that it was competing against the other negative indicators.
Well, we don't think there were any negative indicators. Dr. Lim's publication record demonstrated she's an excellent scientist, sufficient for the university's qualifications for tenure. Its policy says that it values the quality of publications more than mere quantity. The only gauge in the policy says, they should look at the 3 to 5 publications and see whether or not they establish somebody in the field. Dr. Lim has an international reputation as an excellent scientist. There's two kind of research. Research that's incremental research that that advances the, you know, science knowledge just incrementally. In research that is breakthrough, that is at the forefront of scientific thought, and that's the kind of science that Dr. Lin practiced. It's painstaking, it's labor-intensive, it doesn't qualify necessarily for churning out publications.
Yeah, but how is the court to determine whether 10 papers or one paper in the course of that kind of research is appropriate? I suspect some scientists feel on a continuum of 3 years of research that they need to keep informing the academy and the public by 6 papers. Another says it'll be much more of a contribution if I make one at the end. I mean, should a court say the one who waits to give a more fulsome publication at the end is less or more than the one who does 6?
I think the only inquiry that the court makes is whether there's sufficient facts from the university's application of whatever policy it has and the other evidence the plaintiff presents, whether there's sufficient evidence that gender played a motivating role. We do. I think we prove that she's qualified. Many people say she's qualified. Her record says she's qualified. They say, well, her numbers aren't enough. Well, the policy doesn't say those numbers aren't enough. Their application of the policy to similarly situated males demonstrates that there's no absolute number that you got to get enough. Dr. Williams only had 6 publications when he was initially went up for tenure. That was okay. He had been counseled just like Dr. Lim. Dr. Wong had been counseled just like Dr. Lim. Dr. Schwartz had been counseled, each of the latter two having 6, Dr. Wong only having 1. Each of those 3 instances, the university says, well, quality of those publications overcomes the perceived lack of sufficient quantity. So if the university has some arbitrary number of publications that it's enforcing, it's only enforcing that against Dr. Lim, not against similarly situated males, who, if you look at the record in any objective way, do not have the qualifications that she has as a scientist in research.
Did all this get before the court by affidavit on the summary judgment?
Everything was on affidavit or deposition testimony or documents that were produced in discovery, yes. I see I'm entering my rebuttal time. If there's any,
it's your time. But
I understand that. I think that there's very much both direct and circumstantial evidence of pretext of gender discrimination coming into play in this case. At the same time, Dr. Burr is saying she doesn't have enough publications. He's involved in a collaboration with her in which they appropriate her work. Don't give her credit. Now, he wasn't the one that made the decision, but he ratified it, and he lied about it at the inquiry committee and said, no, she didn't have anything involvement. And it's not just that he didn't give credit to her. He also didn't give credit and said that the female that was working under shouldn't get credit either when they gave it to the male. There's plenty of evidence to get this case to the jury, and that's where it should go, not before a judge.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Ms. McLaughlin?
May it please the court, counsel. This appeal is nothing more than an attempt to reweigh and reinvent the examination of a tenure decision, which this court repeatedly has said it does not want to and should not do. There is no dispute in this case of the stated criteria of the number of publications required. Dr. Burr clearly indicated that 1 to 2 publications per year would be required. And the second element of that was that 1/2 of those had to be as a first or senior author. That's undisputed. There also is no dispute that Dr. Lim repeatedly was informed of those criteria and repeatedly throughout her employment at the university was told, you are not meeting those criteria. You need to increase your publications. Now, whether or not that was a good idea, a bad idea, a silly basis for a decision is not at issue here. It was the criteria, and the record is clear, as the district court noted. It is also true that Dr. Lim was given numerous advantages throughout her employment from the very get-go of her hiring up through the time of the appeal of her tenure decision that other candidates didn't receive. She was made an associate professor as opposed to an assistant professor. She received $244,000 for her lab, more than any faculty member in the School of Medicine ever had received. She was allowed to delay her tenure decision 1 year because of the failure to get started and to get her publications going. And then, even at the very end, her appeal was allowed to go clear back to the primary committee, the lowest level, as opposed to the immediate level, as it has been applied before. There certainly is an enormous dispute about whether she should or should not have gotten tenure. She feels she's eminently qualified. The administration obviously felt otherwise. We won't regurgitate all those facts. They are in the record. However, based on counsel's representations, we would urge the court to read those carefully. There are several points that need specific attention. That is, first of all, the attack on President Brand's affidavit, his uncontroverted affidavit, and the letter addressed by counsel.
He says there's a history of gender discrimination in this department.
I believe Justice Mannion correctly pointed to the terms during Dr. Burr's employment. He was employed from 1991 term on. From that time, 41 out of 42 female tenure candidates received tenure. Lim was the only candidate, only female candidate, who did not receive tenure. Indeed, the only other female candidate in the Department of Anatomy, Dr. Moga, was granted tenure with the full support of Dr. Burr. She met those same publishing requirements. She had published 9 peer review articles, 7 of which she was first or senior author. So that's the history before us. Here, if we are to accept counsel's definition of direct evidence, it really turns the definition of that term on its head. The letter he refers to, first of all, you have to ignore the affidavit of President Brand, which says, when I had the chance to review this, it is clear to me there was no discrimination, there was absolutely no unfairness. They could have deposed him under the local rule 56. They had the right to depose him. They didn't. The letter he refers to that was written was not in counsel's possession either. This is a letter that showed up for the first time in their brief, and it's prominently displayed, although not quoted in full in that brief. It does not, in fact, say what counsel represents today that it says, and we would urge the court to read that carefully. That letter, though, if the court is to accept it as direct evidence, you ignore the affidavit of President Brand as to what his conclusion was. You then have to look at the letter involved by one outside the decision. And again, that is uncontroverted. Both President Brand's affidavit says, I was not involved in the decision, and the definition of the Dean of the School of Medicine says that decision, when the Chancellor made it, was final, and President Brand was not involved in that decision. It was written to someone else who was not involved in the decision process. It was written 1.5 years after the tenure decision was made. And is the letter which says, fundamentally, with respect to Lim, I've referred this to the dean. I have not yet received a response. He is looking into it. That's what it says. Certainly, it does not reflect some bias on the part of President Brand. Indeed, it's just the opposite. If anything, it reflects his concern about the situation. And it cannot be used in that context. To have direct evidence, because it is such a fundamental shift, it requires statements by the decision maker, in this case, not President Brand, statements reflecting that decision maker's bias. In this case, there was no such evidence. It cannot be simply an inference or presumption about something that may have happened by another decision maker. President Brand simply was not involved here. To put that letter in context, then, it was remote in time. It was also out of context in terms of its substance. He is responding to an August 98 letter from the director of the Office of Women, explaining her reasons for resigning. It wasn't directed to Dr. Lim specifically. There was one sentence in it in which that director expresses her personal view that, quote, it is likely, seems likely to be a matter of gender discrimination. Now again, read President Brand's response, because he doesn't acknowledge anything about that specific case other than saying, I'm aware of the problem. There's no definition at that stage what the problem is. He certainly is aware, or at that stage we know that Dr. Lim had been denied tenure, she had filed an appeal, she had filed an EEOC charge, so there is ample evidence to suggest that. But there's no definition that the problem he's talking about. And he never suggests that in her instance there was discrimination. Indeed, his affidavit, uncontroverted as it is, says precisely the opposite. On that basis, there can be no holding that there was direct evidence involved here. Next issue, we look to the three male comparators because this certainly misstates the record also. They point to Dr. Wong first. Dr. Wong received tenure in 1989. That's a full year before Dr. Burr even arrived at the university. So it cannot be used as a comparator. Moreover, it is a year before Dr. Burr implemented these publishing criteria, which no one disputes. So he wasn't reviewed and evaluated under those same criteria. So he is out. Next, Dr. Schwartz. Again, the record uncontroverted. 6 peer-reviewed articles. First author on 3. So he does, in fact, meet that stated criteria of 1 to 2 per year, and half of them, excuse me, half of them being first or senior authors. So he's met that criteria. We also note that while Dr. Lim was allowed to add in the appeal process 3 more articles in, if you add those same numbers, both Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Williams' numbers increase. But moving on to Dr. Williams, if you look at his criteria at credentials at the time he was reviewed, he had 7 peer review publications. He was first author on 1, senior author on 5. So he met the criteria. So if you want to apply those criteria and use them as criteria, as comparators, they met those criteria. On its face, that can't be the distinction. Now, certainly, counsel wants the court to review and evaluate whether one was a better scientist than the other. There's no evidence to suggest that wasn't evaluated. It's simply a fact that they did not meet those criteria, be they right or be they wrong or be they smart or be they silly. There is also no question about Dr. Lim's qualifications and her meeting or failing to meet that criteria. At the time she was evaluated, she had 5 peer review publications, 0 as first author and 1 as senior author. Under no scenario could those be viewed as meeting the criteria stated. Certainly one can suggest, as counsel has in their brief, that, well, she had contributions on some of those articles that should have been considered equivalent to senior author or first author. Maybe so, maybe not. The fact is that wasn't the criteria. And the fact is the same criteria was applied to Dr. Lim as applied to the male comparators. The bottom line is that, as Judge Mannion pointed out, 41 of 42 females were granted tenure at that time, during the time Dr. Burr was there. There's no evidence to the contrary. Third of 4 notes would be that this issue of the abstract, it was referred to briefly at the end of counsel's argument, about that she did not receive credit for an abstract, truly is a red herring in this context. That abstract doesn't count toward the publication criteria, so it wouldn't have increased her numbers or allowed her to meet that criteria any more than anything else would have. So that doesn't apply. Moreover, that abstract was submitted in the summer of 1987. That is after the tenure decision was made. So there can't be a conclusion that this act caused her to lose tenure, because the abstract being published was done after her tenure decision already was made. Thirdly, there is absolutely no evidence in this record that Dr. Burr consented to or was in any way involved in the determination of authorship for that abstract. His affidavit says he was not. The only evidence in the record, Dr. Pavalko says, I, Dr. Pavalko, made that decision, and Dr. Burr was not involved in it. That is the only evidence on that issue. Finally, the issue of qualified immunity. Dr. Burr briefed this issue below. The district court didn't have to address it because it granted summary judgment on other grounds. The entire response to this defense in Dr. Lim's brief was one sentence, a single sentence, that said she had the right to be free of gender discrimination. The law of this court is clear that it must be a clearly established right, and some general pronouncement of a general right cannot suffice. If the court is to accept Dr. Lim's argument in this case, then there could be no finding of qualified immunity in any discrimination context. There could be none in any context of almost any type of right, because it is simply a general pronouncement. If it is enough to say Title VII suggests there can be no gender discrimination, and we don't look at the facts, then that has been ruled out. And the law of this circuit suggests that it would obliterate the clearly established standard. While we are prepared to address any questions of the court, the remainder of the issues have been fully briefed, and we are prepared to rest on those briefs.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin.
This isn't just an attempt to reweigh whether she's qualified or not. This is really a presentation of whether or not there was sufficient evidence in the record of whether gender played a role with respect to Dr. Burr's ratification of the denial of authorship credit. Yes, it happened after the initial denial of her tenure, but it does show some evidence of discriminatory intent. If he's ratifying the decision to deny authorship credit to two females, but approving it for a male. With respect to whether her senior authorship on these papers, the record's clear that authorship placement is just an indicator of contribution to a publication. It might tell you a lot, it might tell you nothing. That's what the record shows. And the record shows in this case that the primary committee and Dr. Burr were aware that she had made significant contributions, equivalent of senior authorship, on three of her initial five papers, and that they gave her credit essentially as such in the earlier 95 primary committee review, documented with letters from those people. Take that in contrast to Dr. Williams' deposition testimony, which he acknowledges that the 91 paper, which he didn't even publish before he came to IU, which was published afterwards, that he was listed as a senior author, but really all the experiments were designed and done by his father down in his lab in Memphis, and he really was just last author, not senior author. So Dr. Burr and the primary committee knew that. He comes, Dr. Burr, in August of 91, and he lists that paper was submitted back in February of 91 as one of his publications. Dr. Burr says he wasn't even up and running initially when he came. They knew he didn't make that paper when he was there, and that he didn't make a substantial contribution to that paper, and yet they artificially say, oh, well, for him, we're going to give him senior authorship credit because he's listed first. With respect to the numbers, the numbers of 42 out of 41 made it, 41 out of 42 made it. That's for the whole Department of Medicine, I take it from Lynn Wakefield's affidavit, with respect to the relevant time period for discovery, which the court gave us from 85 to the time of Dr. Lynn's termination. There were eight people that went up in the Department of Anatomy for tenure, six men and two women. The six men were approved for tenure, the two women were denied. Again, there's a lot of statistical evidence, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that shows that, and some direct evidence that shows that gender played a motivating role in her adverse tenure decision, and it's for the trier of fact to sort out that evidence rather than for a judge. And so we respectfully request that the court reverse the district court and remand this case for trial.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And